Hi. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I have the honor of introducing to you the panelists for tonight. I learned only today that the origin of the word nostalgia is Swiss. And my husband was very happy to learn this because he, of course, grew up in Switzerland and reminisces fondly about all things Swiss, even though we're never going to live there. Today we use the word nostalgia to describe the emotions prompted by a person, time, or thing of the past. And whether we think of our generation or our parents' generation or our children's generation, whatever audience it is, our culture, society, and we as individuals are continuously referring to the past. So on behalf of the Young Lions Committee, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce to you Leslie Bloom, Jonathan Adler, Sally Singer, and Jason Wu, who are here with us tonight to discuss this subject. In addition to our panelists, the library's very own Michael Inman and Jessica Pigza have put together for us a collection of ephemera from the library's own archives, which is contained in the cases on the side of the room. So I hope you'll check it out on your way out if you haven't already. And Leslie will be here after we conclude the panel to sign books. Thank you very much for coming this evening. And for those of you who are Young Lions members already, we really appreciate your support. The library, as you know, is one of the institutions that immediately gets penalized during a tough fiscal year, and this is certainly one of them. And for those of you who are not Young Lions members, I hope you'll join. It's a fantastic group. We organize events like this throughout the year, and it's a pleasure to have you here tonight. Thank you.
Hi, so can you hear me? I have my mic in my lap, actually. I'm delighted and honored to be here tonight to sort of celebrate and investigate the work of Leslie Bloom, who's here with the hat to my left.
Which is in danger of catapulting off at any moment, so I apologize.
When Leslie asked me, and it was some months ago, because I was still at Vogue, to do this, I wasn't really sure if I was the right fit because I'm not really drawn to period dramas. I'm not someone who sort of revels in sort of Mad Men and, I don't know, Jane Austen fare. And I've never really seen myself as that kind of person. And this was before I think you even had copies of your galleys. And then I got the copies of the galleys. And I realized that I was a slattern, word I'd never heard before, and I live in a hotel, and I own a jukebox. I really like to eat marzipan fruit. I adore chuckles, which is a candy, not a form of giggling. I take milk baths. I send handwritten notes. I keep clippings albums. I love a Zeppelin. I love the film Madam Satan, where there's a party on a Zeppelin. That's one of my favorite films. And in terms of fashion, I've always believed that people should buy quality over quantity. That's something I talk about a lot, something I believe very strongly, and it's also in Leslie's book. One of the things I like most about this book, because I get to talk about this book, and then we all just get to chat about what's in it, is that it's really great when you're feeling lousy, which is also a category of experience that you could feel if you're reading Leslie's book, because it's in Leslie's book. If you're feeling lousy and you read this book, I think it awakens you to things that have made you happy in your life, and made you happy not because they're nostalgic for sort of fetishistic or cliched reasons. They make you happy because they remind you of a time when certain things, certain ideas, certain gestures got you through a period in your life. And in a way, it's because the gestures and the totems and the things in this book sort of promote and revel in an idea of a life that's lived in 3D, not 2D, that's lived publicly and civilly and civically and not necessarily privately, because that which is private in here is there's a wonderful understanding that other people are doing it too. And that is a very kind of wonderful thing, particularly, as I said, when you're feeling lousy. And feeling lousy is, again, a category of experience that is something we're supposed to bring back. So I'm all about bringing it back. I can do it any day. What I want to talk about tonight, what I think we should talk about tonight, is what's really not lousy in the book, which are the political ramifications of this kind of idea that looking backwards is not... It's not actually a form of conservatism. It's actually a form of liberalism. It allows you to think about creating opportunities, again, civically, publicly, in which people's fates and ideas about the world are linked through custom and tradition and ritual and courtesy. And then I also think the sort of social ramifications of it. And then, of course, because we have these wonderful panelists here, Jonathan and Jason, the aesthetic ramifications of looking backwards to look forwards. And so I thought I would open up by asking Jason and then Jonathan, how do you do that? How do you look backwards and yet be directional, which is the key thing all designers have to be?
Well, I think, you know, when I look at design, I feel like it's, well, design's all around us. And I feel like, you know, as a designer, you know, when I was growing up and I was wanting to be a fashion designer, I was aspiring to be somebody who designs before I even knew what fashion was, I took so much time in reading about anything and everything I could find about design, and that includes designers of all sorts, costume designers, fashion designers, jewelry designers, architects, and I think, you know, it's impossible to create the future without knowing the past, and that's really a theory I believe strongly in. And, you know, before I realized I wanted to be a designer, I spent a lot of time researching what it is and those who've done it before me were doing. So I think it's important.
And since you started with dolls, did you? Because Jason is actually a very successful doll designer and started doing dolls when he was like in high school or something, right? Professionally, like in a big way, like in a really major commercial, will fund a company and allow you to design clothes for the first lady kind of way. Did you play out that those kind of historical concepts in the work with the dolls you were doing for this company?
In the beginning, actually, I was just in a boarding school, and I was bored out of my mind, and I wanted to do something. And I was like, what do I do? Well, let me just, there's a doll company's hiring, so let me do something, because it's design. And I think, you know, that's whether I'm a fashion designer, doll designer, whatever, it's all design-oriented. And I later look back, and I realized that, you know, there are great fashion designers in the past that have used dolls and miniature as a canvas to study what is it that we do. It's like looking at a map, because when I first learned pattern making and second year in Parsons, when we had pattern making and we were all sort of new and don't know what's going on, we were learning pattern making, and they gave us miniature patterns because we could instantly figure out what a sleeve shape looked like without trying to, and that was the fundamental. And I was like, wait, I know how to do this. I've been doing it for 9 years already. And so that was sort of an interesting thing that I actually came back to. And I also think, you know, the idea of dolls, I think sort of like artifact. And I always say, like, the dolls sort of always mimic what's going on right now. And if you look back in history, artifacts of the Met, and there's always a doll-like object that mimicked what was going on at the time. So I think that's interesting. It helps us learn about ourselves, perhaps.
So you think dolls are an old form that reveal the present?
Yeah, or record the present.
Do you think the same about ceramics?
Is ceramics a record of the past? Ceramics is ancient.
We know that.
So there's a long history about which to be nostalgic. Mm. And I reckon... When I think about design, I strive to make stuff that is familiar but fresh at the same time. And I think that's what design should be now. You know, I feel like nostalgia has been an important part of design since, forever. But there was a brief period maybe in the 50s and 60s when modernism started and people were doing things that were absolutely new or seemed very new. Since then, we've been living in an era that is often about retreading the past, whether it be like the 1970s Art Deco revival, the 80s Ralph Lauren revival. And, you know, we still continue to be in the postmodern time in which design is referential. And I think at this point, it would be very difficult for design not to be referential. You know, with the internet, you'd have to work really, really hard to not see stuff. And I think that it's really important for designers to be connoisseurs. You know, Jason was saying you have to know the history in order to do the future. And that's so true. And I think that the most important thing is that you understand all the references that you're making when you make something. You know, if I make a pot, I need to know how, you know, what percentage of it is inspired by Hans Köper and what percentage of it is Wiener Werkstatt. I need to sort of understand what the references are so that I can go beyond them. And so I think, like, you know, I said, I think design should be familiar and fresh at the same time. And there's always an element of nostalgia to everything I do, and I reckon to everything anybody does. The challenge is, how do you make it new? And I think, I guess this is kind of hard to explain, but when I am making a pot, for instance, like I just did this horse bowl that I'm very fond of, and it just kind of looked great, and I thought, why does this pot look good? And I thought, you know, it just looks like it's supposed to be that way. And when something looks like it's supposed to be that way, it almost creates an instant feeling of nostalgia. You know, it's like new design, if it's good, feels familiar and it feels like something you can be nostalgic for. And I think the first time that idea really lodged into my head was when I heard Lenny Kravitz's song, It Ain't Over Till It's Over. And I thought, oh, how genius of him to remake this song. And then I was like, oh, no, he didn't remake this song. This is a brand new song. You know, and I thought, there's definitely a little throwback element to it, but more than anything, that song just sounds exactly like it's supposed to be that way. So I think that when new design is good, it has you understand there might be a little throwback element, but it should just feel instantly familiar, and it's almost like nostalgia should be an instantaneous emotion.
Do you often feel when you're making, you know, so many of the things that you make could be, you know, seen as out of date in many people's homes or many people's, not out of date, but things that people put in their homes to keep traditions alive, like, you know, from a dinner party to whatever, you know, the things that you don't necessarily need but you want because they allow you to live in a certain way, in a, you know, with a certain idea. There are ever things where you just think, you know, I really need, like, I don't know, an egg cup today. I don't know what it is, but like, where you get a craving for something that you haven't had around recently, and you think,
sure,
I know this is referencing 1972 in my house, but I feel.
I have like an amazing job because I get to just sort of, my job is that I get to think, what do I want to have? And then I just make it. So that's pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, everyone should be so lucky.
So what have you wanted to have recently?
Well, like, I just did this new piece that's coming out. It'll soon be available on www.jonathanadler.com. That is a peacock menorah. And it's one of my favorite pieces I've ever done. And I thought, I was looking at a peacock, and I thought, you know, that's a perfect form for a menorah. And it was sort of a cheeky idea, but when you look at it, I hope you'll see that I feel like it's one of those pieces that looks exactly like it's supposed to be that way. So, and in my world, in the home design world, it's really hard to get people to buy something. It's not like fashion where, you know, if it makes your ass look thin, you'll buy it in 8 colors and, you know, in home, right, 1 color. In home, it's a high bar to get people to make the decision to buy something and ship it home, deal with all the packing peanuts that come with the shipment. So I'm lucky to be in a world where you have to work really hard to make somebody want something. I think a lot about what do I really, really want, and then I make it.
Peacock menorah.
Peacock menorah, check it out. It's really groovy.
So that's the end of the book. You've got 9 zillion things in this book. What are like your top 5 things that for yourself? That you're happy.
Well, it's difficult to say because the content of the book is so diverse, and the book is looking at personalities from bygone eras. It's looking at recipes, landmarks, words, fashions, I tend to like the more absurd things that I know reviewers are going to be like, what is she talking about? And that I'm actually pretty astonished made the final cut. Like, for instance, with recipes, for instance, my favorite one is this crazy thing called Stargazy Pie. Nobody ever wants to resurrect old British cuisine. It's usually a no-no, but I found a way to bring it back. And in this pie, it's a fish pie, and they have fish heads sticking up, and they call it stargazy because it looks like they're gazing at the stars. And my idea, because Let's Bring Back is really about taking things from the past and making them relevant to modern day, so my big updating of the stargazy pie is you have lobster heads crawling out instead, because who doesn't like a lobster? And it's so surrealist. So that's my favorite recipe. Nobody, I'm sure, will be rushing off to make that one. I'm honestly, it's almost like asking somebody to choose among, you know, there are many children, and you know, I love everything in this book. From this sounds like a digression, but it's not. It's wrapping back. My very patient husband, who has lived with this book for the last 2 years in the making, he's read the manuscript as it was coming together, and any time we had a new guest contributor bring something in, he heard about the entry. And then he read it a few weeks ago for the first time in book format, and he said, this is like reading your diary. And it really is. So everything is very dear to me. But I love bloomers. I love the Marchesa Cassati. I love beauty spots as a creative way to cover up a zit. Bustles is a great way to hide a big butt. I wish I had one right now, but you can't sit in a bustle. All kinds of words. I do love the word slattern. You are not a slattern. Although this book is a love letter to Sally Singer.
All right. I really like all the one word ones. I like all the pithy things. I like jawbreakers, which are candy tinged with danger. What could be more enticing to a kid? Or one piece swimsuits. Bikinis are grand, but it's hard to live up to their expectations. We all feel that. Particularly since this book is entirely about candy, by the way. So there's no way you can wear a bikini after you have it.
I was a tomboy with a sweet tooth growing up. So.
And I love this one, red cabooses on trains, like an exclamation point at the end of a long Jamesian sentence, which I thought was a really nice one for the library. It's very, very pithy. What are your favorite things that you saw in this book?
Well, I love a figgy pudding.
All right.
I like a pudding of any sort, but figgy pudding is especially delicious. So, and yeah, I love old-fashioned foods. I feel like it brings certain comfort, and you know, it's you know, among so many new things in the world, I think it's nice to have some things that are maybe not so new, but just as great.
Are you all dinner party throwers? Do you throw dinner?
Yes.
You?
I am too busy.
Dinner parties
studio.
Are fun.
I'd love to say that I am one, but I have been working at it. But my day job is unfortunately blends into the nighttime.
So you would throw often. Amazing dinner parties with figgy pudding.
When I do one day, I will do it. And the stargazers.
I will bring, if it's potluck, I will bring the stargazers. Yeah, I'm a pathological dinner party thrower.
And what are like the five elements of a good dinner party?
So easy. It's ridiculous. It's, okay,
take notes. Here we go.
Because dark room and lots of candles, because nothing flatters women better than candlelight.
And men.
Everybody. Oh, and make sure that the candles are high and not low, because if you're underlit, then everybody jowls. But if you're lit high, then it's all cheekbones. So, candelabras, dark room. Okay, then the perfect playlist. My husband's amazing at that. And then you want some kind of food that's not fussy, where people feel communal. And it can be elegant food, but just where people feel involved in some way. And there have to be five?
No, it could be.
Well, obviously, heaps of booze. Before, after, during. So that's four. And then, one thing that always makes dinner parties amazing is to be no wild stretch of the imagination, if you have some kind of wild hat lying around and you make a bet with yourself who is going to be the first person to wear that hat. So I usually keep a top hat casually lying around. Now the interesting thing about that is that it invariably ends up on a woman's head, the top hat, and it's usually before the second course. So that's my 5-point guide to creative dinner throwing in a small space too. And I think it's also important because we're all New Yorkers. People don't throw dinner parties as much in New York because we all live in dollhouse size apartments. And with this guide, this foolproof guide, you can make any space look beautiful and dramatic. It's all just about the light and the booze.
Jonathan, what do you do? What do you throw to?
Dinner parties. My dinner parties always have an element of nostalgia because there's nothing worse than futuristic food. Like the foam movement in food is, I'm convinced it's like a plot by some, you know, enemy country.
Barcelona.
Yeah, I think that they're out to like ruin our lives with this foam movement. And so dinner parties inevitably are not futuristic. They're about making food that you can actually make at home. Who doesn't love a roast chicken and a, you know, steamed veggie? So they're always nostalgic. It's always simple food. I believe in serving myself first because I am under the delusion that it'll make people feel more comfy, but it really addresses my hunger. And I always like to have an old movie on the telly on mute. So I think it's always good to have, like, Mommy Dearest or Boys in the Band just on mute. And, you know, it's a nice distraction. So there's always nostalgic elements and inevitably very, very homey and comfy.
And the fact that you have a television is in itself nostalgic. So that's quite... Everyone else has got their, like their iPad or something.
No, the kids who work for me today, like, they don't have TVs.
They don't have
and
TVs?
They see everything on the computer, and I don't understand. It makes no sense.
What do you think that you thought would come back? And then when you tried it, it didn't work. It was like, ugh, nostalgia, as opposed to good nostalgia. Oh, come on, there must be something.
I'm kind of embarrassed to say, because I have to admit to having made it, but I had a Mad Men dinner party a few months ago, and we decided it would be a grand idea to make a brisket.
Wow.
It was like a pot roast, but it was like the worst thing that ever happened to anybody who was sitting at that table. And fortunately,
was it not a good brisket, or was it?
It was from the New York Times cookbook, the 1966 one, the seminal one, so it should have been perfectly divine. It even had a French name. It was horrible.
Brisket.
brisket. But fortunately, because of the 5-point plan, the booze and the light saved the situation. So I highly recommend not making a pot roast for company. Some things just are best left in the past.
Have you ever, at Design Wisp, have you ever tried to do something and thought, ugh, now old?
The whole aggressive AD thing was, I would say, that was the movement I just was not a part of. And I thought, as much as I grew up watching my mom getting dressed up, the one thing I didn't miss was the big shoulder pads.
That is a hard gesture to bring back into. Have you ever just...
Very difficult.
Well, in terms of design, God, I wish there was some rhyme or reason to what succeeds and what doesn't. I find when I design stuff... it's not necessarily that I'm bringing something back. It's just what's, bubbling up inside of me. If it's something that's totally idiosyncratic, it seems to be more successful than something that ain't. So, I think, I don't know, when I think too hard about bringing something back, it doesn't necessarily succeed.
It just has to feel right.
It has to feel right in its time, I guess, is what it is, really.
But that's luck. A lot of the time, and sometimes you could bring something back and the environment isn't right for it and it just doesn't resonate in the right way.
Do you ever have that with writing, Ralph? Do you ever like write in a voice where you're like, voice doesn't work anymore?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, when I look back at my, I mean, I am also an author of children's books, and I looked back at some of the earliest novels, and it's not even me anymore. But just circling back to something we were talking about in the earlier when Jonathan was talking about how everything is sort of referential. It's that way in writing also. Mm-hmm. And I think the most complicated thing in writing is always. Finding an original voice. And I remember one time I was doing a search, I was trying to find a quote on originality, and all of the quotes were about originality, had to do with originality is simply being good at masking your sources. And it's the same, you know, it's the same sort of thing for mm-hmm. me. And so I know who influences me consistently, and I always have to try really hard not to sound like them because it's extremely discrediting. But at the same time, you know, still draw what I...
You can't help it because people who write well read a lot, and that's basically it. It's not like anyone's taught to write. If you've read a lot in your life, you're a better writer.
But if something isn't explicitly plagiarized in writing, isn't it sort of original no matter what? I think writing's a great medium for hiding your sources.
It can be, but I have to say, and for myself, there have definitely, because I don't design things, I don't write things, I've definitely had periods where, was much, 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 much younger, where, you know, I knew I was pulling a version of a this writer or that writer. I mean, I have worked through Saul Bellow phrasing. I've worked through Edmund White. I've worked through, you know, a lot. I've worked through E.B. White. You know, E.B. White was a good one. E.B. White's a great one, actually. I mean, for anyone, it's like it's spot on, like New Yorker prose of a certain moment, and clear and crisp and has that. You know, like, and you know you're doing it. Because you know that it conveys things in a certain way, and then you know you have to, like, then things change, and it just doesn't feel, that sort of phrasing doesn't feel right anymore, and you're not sure why, because it still conveys things in the right way, but the times move on, and your voice adjusts to the times. And it happens without you thinking too hard about it, but when you go back, you think, yeah, like, I just, that wasn't the moment to refer to that. And, you know, there isn't, you know, futuristic writing doesn't work either for the same reasons. Whenever you see someone deliberately form bashing, you're like, you know, you're not Thomas Pynchon and no one read him anyway. How about that? Like, where are we?
It points to the question, really, which I think is an implicit question in the book, is anything original? And yes and no. I mean, it's... Everything is referential to a certain degree, but voice is everything, and voice translates into design, obviously. And also, any product, whether it's writing or a design, it's contextual, and it's like the old Billie Holiday song. It's the same old story, but it's new to me. So it's original to the person who's experiencing it for the first time in this totally new context. So. Yes, there is always, you know, the updated, relevant version. So when I am homaging E.B. White, I'm like, oh, this is an homage. In a new modern way, this is not ripping him off literally.
I mean, I think when it comes to being referential, everything is referential. I think that our responsibility as writers or designers is to take whatever we're referencing and make it better rather than worse. And so, you know, that's I think the most important thing. And I often see in my world, a lot of my stuff gets copied. I shouldn't say who, it's a company whose name begins with W and ends in Est Elm. But anyway, I'm sort of like fine with them copying my stuff. It's like, great, I appreciate it. The thing that I think is a bummer about what often happens when people copy things in the contemporary world is that they make them worse rather than better. And I think that that's where the idea of connoisseurship and really understanding your references comes into play. And it's really, you know, so if someone's going to copy my stuff, I'd rather they look at it, see what's wrong with it, think, oh, you know, if you put a little bit more Hans Köper and a little less Lucy Rhee into that, it would be that much better. And then, you know, riff off something that I or anybody else has already done, but take it to the next level. That's sort of, that's the nature of evolution in the world we live in, where everything is visually available. So, everything's referential, but I think our responsibility is to make it original by making it better.
I may agree with that. I just, you know, from the last season, we're looking at a lot of 70s stuff, and you know, we look at it, and you know, it was like all these inspiration pictures, and you you do that kind of silhouette, and then you know, I sit down, we look at it on a fit model, and like, she looks like she came straight out of a 1970s something. And, you know, how do you make a new? Well, by injecting me in it, because I'm living in today. So I think that's how you make something new. But, you know, in today, where everything is knocked off before your own product comes out, you know, it's sometimes a little difficult to do that because, you know, people that look at something doesn't sometimes understand its references.
Right, that's it. You just have to be sharp about it. It's about, like, I think the key to being a good designer is the ability to be analytical and say, if you make something that comes from an idea from the 70s and you make it and you see the first sample and you're like, that just looks like it's from the 70s, the real test of a designer's mettle, if that's the cliche, is their ability to analyze what's wrong with it, know what the reference is, and then take it to the next level. And that's really the difference. You know, the bad knockoff artists make it worse. Good people understand the references and take it to the next level.
I've seen with the 70s, which is the 70s right now, it's hugely in fashion going into spring, for those of you who don't have to see as many clothes as I do in the world. The ones where it looks right, and I was, Les and I were talking about this earlier, where it looks right is the instances in which the designer has figured out somewhat in the silhouette or in the proportion something in the 70s silhouette and proportion that meant something to them. And it might be, it's usually with designers, it's what, you know, what they saw adults looking like when they were like 12 or 13. It's something in that. And they either react badly to it, in the case of your mother's shoulder pads, or they react sort of emotionally to it. And it's often designers who have figured out something in the feeling of the line of the 70s that mattered to them, but without any of the details that make it 70s. They either strip it back or they embellish it differently, but you see in the gesture that moment, as opposed to people where you know they bought the vintage piece and then they redid it because it looks right. And sometimes even that's kind of fun because it looks like, you know, it's like so amazingly rendered and then it's shrunken and reduced and twisted and, you know, but it has to push it beyond. It either has to get so literal it gets like freaky and kind of exciting, or it has to be so abstracted, and that's where I think it really works, where you see that someone's emotional life was connected to a moment. And it's only the essence of the thing that's left. It's only the sort of fleeting whiff of something. It's like a picture when the picture's gone.
Like the reference should be the starting point rather than the finish point. And again, that comes from being really analytical. And you're so right. Like, you can take a gesture from the 70s, tweak the proportion, and it becomes totally different. Isolate the element. It makes it totally different. So, again, it's about having all the references and knowing what to do with them.
I think, I mean, it's true for a consumer of fashion as well as a designer also. And when you're looking at certain periods coming back, like how do you wear those things? And if you wear them in a very literal sense, and especially if you're a vintage lover like I am, you know, it's really, really risky. And if you buy a piece, you run the risk of looking costumey if you don't accessorize it in the right way. And the challenge is, and it's, I feel like it's a skill that is learned as opposed to something that, well, no, it's probably instinctive too, but the challenge is to evoke the essence without being a clown of that era. And I mean, I feel like we're in this environment right now where it's a very permissive environment, aesthetically speaking. We're kind of moving out of the Rachel Zoe look-alike contest that we've been enslaved to for the last 5-10 years. And now, you know, you can sort of, you know, pick and choose. We're seeing such a huge array of influences over the last, you know, the last few fashion cycles, and, you know, people are savifying to vintage and how to wear it and pull it together.
Do you think that?
Now these fashion cycles sort of a month.
Yeah, very quickly.
And, you know, that's why I feel like, you know, as a designer, I've always sort of strived to do something that isn't really trend-driven, meaning, you know, I look at the collection as building on a wardrobe of my client. What doesn't she have, and what can I add to it, and how can I bring a fresh point of view to it this season, versus what's going to be trendy this season? Because I feel like it's become such a contemporary keyword. You know,
well,
especially.
I think it's a fabulous time we live in because nothing's trendy and everything's trendy right now. You know,
exactly.
It's not like in the 60s when there was when the fashion world and the design world was small, and you know, if a skirt went up 3 inches, everybody did it. Now everybody does everything, so it's a fabulous time to be a designer because you can do anything, and it can be ever more personal. And the key is that it's just a great time because you don't have to just follow trends. You just have to make something that does connect with people emotionally. So it's, you know, that's where I think nostalgia really plays an important role, in the sense that nostalgia is about emotion, and I think emotion and personality is what enables you to sell stuff and create a brand or a biz.
Do you think that there's anything new now in the world of like technology and all that has the capacity to have that kind of hold or to linger? I mean, you know, I remember, I think when I first came to Vogue, there was the cell phone that the designer of which, and I should never remember which one it was. It was a Motorola. It was a pillow on a rock. They had designed something that looked like a pillow on a rock. If you remember that cell phone, it was like a hump on a something. And literally, the guy out in Mountain View or whoever made it, we went out to interview him, and he was like, "It's a pillow on a rock. That is what I saw when they made this phone." And you thought that had, and at the moment that phone, which I can't even remember the name of now, which shows you just how right. Came out, it seemed like, aha, the bread loaf cell phone was over, we'd moved from the giant walkie-talkie, we'd stripped it back and back and back, and now we had essentially a pillow on a rock, and it felt very organic, it felt like it could last forever, it felt we were finally had hit the moment, and then, you know, the razor came out, or whatever the next thing came out, it was gone in instant design-wise. And I'm wondering, do you think anything in the world of tech can have that kind of emotional resonance where it will hold? I mean, is it the MacBook? Is it a Jonathan Ives thing? Do you, is there any sort of thing where you like the feel of it, or you feel, not, Jonathan's like, forget it, I don't know where you are.
No, well, I mean, my opinion is everything will feel like that until the next thing that we don't know about comes along.
But do you think that there's anything that's being designed that takes a shape where people will rely on it? And say, I mean, it might be, I don't know, it could be the way Mac icons drop down, that there were people will remember that they were that age when they could use a computer that way, and every, or you know, that, and then, or it'll be the scroll. I thought about this because, like, what in 20 years will it be, the scroll on your, I don't have an iPhone, but if I had an iPhone, the way people like flip with their hand and suddenly like all of their family albums are revealed, and you think, whoa, that's like such a gesture. I mean, it has all the hallmarks of it. It has a gesture. It's a way to show personal things. I don't know.
Like, I would say that first of all, the technology is, it looks totally in a different direction than nostalgia. I mean, technology's allure is that it's the next thing. And it, as Jonathan was saying, the beauty lasts until the next thing replaces it. But I feel like if there's one iconic thing that this generation will remember in terms of emerging technology, will be the dial on the original iPod.
Right.
That round thing, you know, that first, mm-hmm. that,
yeah.
And I mean, and that is already, that's gone. That's like the way of Atari. I still have, you know,
they don't do that anymore?
Well,
no.
I mean, I have that. We have a slew of iPods lying around the house, but I'm very loyal to my white second generation iPod, and I was trotting around with it a few weeks ago, and somebody said, "Hey, I like your vintage iPod." And I was like, oh! You know, I mean, so it's vintage already. So I feel like that is the thing. And then maybe people will remember the lushness of the screens of the iPhone, like seeing color like that for the first time. Right. It must have been like seeing like Technicolor for the first time in the late 30s in movies.
It could, yeah. I mean, because a lot of things in this book, which are not the candy items I was mentioning earlier, the bonbons, and are technological things. It's things like jukeboxes and, you know, mechanical devices that were charming because there was a, like, jukebox, someone who, sorry, owns a jukebox, it's the drop of the record. I have a 60s one. But it's that, it's the way the things, you know, it's those kind of gestures which make you think, oh, now it's working, or it's moving, or something's going to happen. And those, and it's true that iPods have that. You could swirl it, you know. You need a gesture, don't you think?
Well, I think that when you talk about technology as it relates to design, there's sort of an inherently comical element to it. Like, you know, when someone sees your vintage iPod, they like laugh about it and think, oh, what a clunker. And yet, because they're remembering a time when you got that, that was the future. And it's gone so many stages beyond. Like, I just
did
this.
It's like Gordon Gekko's cell phone.
Right, it's Gordon Gekko's cell phone. It's hilarious. Yeah. But when he had it, it was like, oh my God, look at that cell phone. He's important.
Yeah. Like, I just ripped here.
Right, it's like, wow. And it's funny. It used to be that having a cell phone was like a sign of importance. And now I'm starting to wonder if not having one is a sign of importance. You know, it all just flips. But, like, I just did this really silly thing. It's like a match strike, which is a place you hold matches and strike the thing, which is sort of a nostalgic idea. But the thing that holds the matches is a boombox, like in a little porcelain boombox that's like this big. And it's just sort of a visual pun because boomboxes are hilarious. It's like hard to imagine a time when people would walk down the street with a boombox. You know? And that's, but when you were walking down the street with the boombox, you were like, And so that's sort of the nature of, when you think about technology and nostalgia, it's with this, there's an inherent comedy built into it.
And endearing element also. I mean, there's also, you know, the scorn of the boombox. But, I mean, for me, like, we have two record players in the house, one upstairs, one downstairs. And they're just so endearing. And music sounds different on them. And, I mean, yes, they're absurd. And if you're having a dinner party, you have to keep running back and forth to flip the record or whatever. But it's what we were talking about in clothing. It evokes the essence of something that you knew earlier. And the sound... People say that smell is the most evocative sense, but I think sound is also incredibly evocative in ways that we don't really understand. And for me, like the plopping of the needle onto the record, and just that first few rungs before the record starts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, you know, you'll remember it till you know you die.
And sound is so important, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
And a lot of people use that in records now. They digitally put that little creakety thing. So it's really a fantastic material for anybody who makes things or thinks of things to toy with all those nostalgic things and know just which bits to use when and where.
When do you think what decades do you think are ripe for sort of nostalgic plucking, and what things don't you think work? I mean, right now you have a sort of wave of 90s nostalgia in fashion. You have a lot of people remembering sort of Helmut Lang, who just lives in the Hamptons. It's like, it's not hard. He's still alive, still around. But, but there's this idea that the 90s, you know, because fashion moves so quickly that we can now, you know, it was, you know, 20 years ago, early 90s. Is that already, I mean, you have people in you have models in your book from the, who I remember, from 70s, 80s, don't you? You move up a bit. It's not all super far in the past.
No. Well, I mean, Let's Bring Back draws on a huge array of epochs from ancient Rome, very applicable things like chariots, to the 1970s is the drop off. And actually, I heard at another New York Public Library talk, your former colleague, Grace Coddington, talking about the eras that she loves. And you know, she has this, anytime you see a Grace Coddington spread, you know that it's her. And she said that I love the 1920s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, but you know, the 60s and 70s and 80s are not interesting to me. I only like what came before me. And I think, you know, for me, I had always adored everything from before me. But now that Mad Men came back and I'm seeing a lot of, you know, my childhood in that, it like made me realize that there is no decade that isn't fascinating in retrospect and doesn't have, you know, incredible things that should be brought back from it. I mean, yes, obviously we should cherry pick from each decade what we want to bring back. That's what, you know, Let's Bring Back is about. It's about curating the lovely things from the past and leaving the ugly things.
So what are we bringing back in the 80s?
I'll let you guys talk about this later.
What is the exuberance in the 80s? I think I love. I mean, you know, as much as I just like the shoulder pads, I remember so much great things in the 80s. I mean, everything was so colorful and everything was so, you know, and it almost seemed like less conservative than where we are right now.
Yeah, the 80s are great. I mean, I'm rocking a teal shoelace even as we speak. So, yeah, I love the 80s. I love the color. I love the freaky airbrushing period, and there's in any time there's always moments, you know. And airbrushing, which seems so futuristic, was sort of a Maxfield Parrish reference but made new. So there's always freaky little pockets of things to understand.
But even the much hated shoulder pads, which were the emblem of the 80s for many, you know, women especially, when going to work in their shoulder padded suits. I mean, they were actually brought out in the 30s. And they were heralded as this very big thing because they made waists look narrow. And so much of the 80s, the kookiness of the certain attire drew on surrealism and reviving that a lot also. So once again, we're looking back at how, you know, some of the things that we would resurrect in the 80s were actually things that were resurrected already.
And how much do you think, just to play off the 80s, how much do you think the appeal of certain forms of nostalgia now have to do with the sort of economic downturn of the last few years and the kind of slow, creaky recovery that we're supposedly in the moment? I mean, how much do you... So much of this book, for those of you who can buy it later if you haven't bought it already, and Leslie will be signing it in the corner, so much of this book is about things that don't actually cost a lot, but that do a lot for you, style-wise, I would say. I mean, you know, small gestures that can kind of, you know, change your home or change your look or change the way you socialize without having to, you know, invest any more than, you know, sort of writing a postcard or, you know, putting out a handkerchief. I mean, they're very small gestures. And do you think that there's any relationship between that?
If I could greedily leap in, I mean, hugely. But, I mean, Let's Bring Back actually began as a column in 2007, and at that point, it was Gilded Age still, and it was really, it was meant to be kind of a counterpoint to consumerism, not in an obnoxious way, but it was, everybody, it was like the next it bag, this, that, the other, you know, boom. And so it was like, here are all the quieter, lovelier things that, you know, you're not looking at anymore. And then, you know, along comes Lehman and the economy is in the toilet. And now everybody, probably less so now, I feel like people are already starting to look forward. As of the last 6 months, people are like, let's deal with this and move forward. But I feel like over the last couple of years, a lot of people have been in this sulky repentance mode where they're like, oh, you know, we really... It overextended ourselves, and maybe it is time to look at
spaghetti suppers or
that sort of thing. I mean, this is not about simple pleasures. I mean, let me be clear, there's a lot of decadence in this book, but but I mean, I think a lot of people were, it's a reexamination before and after of throwing away and consuming more. And even now, I mean, it's still like technology, it's like always about the next thing. Like, we're 10% unemployment, but we are still finding the money to buy iPads. We are still finding the money to buy everything. And so it does play a role. And it was a little bit weird for me to be releasing this book into an environment when all of a sudden people just happened to be reconsidering all of their habits. So it was a strange moment of serendipity.
There's some good points in there, though. There's like some really... Like, I thought one thing I really appreciate was the fit, that the you talk about fit being a small luxury. Mm-hmm. I would say one thing that I, you know, I do trunk shows and I meet my clients, and one thing I would say that a lot of my clients need to be educated on is the need to fit a garment. Yes. Because it's sort of ingrained in men's mind that you have to fit a suit, but for a lot of women, they feel like the dress should go on. And I just think, you know, nobody sort of has the same body or even the same size, and I think having the perfect fit is such an important aspect. And it goes, you know, and it goes beyond just because something's expensive doesn't mean it looks good. I think it has to fit well, and it has to look
absolutely
expensive.
Well, it's like Edith Head used to say, you fit the dress to the woman and not the woman to the dress.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a time when tailoring was extremely important, and it still should be, even though, I mean, this, evidence of the fact that it has actually gone, you know, out of style to understand fit or retailoring, I mean, that there are fewer and fewer fine tailors in New York, every year because there just isn't, they're not kept in business. But you can take, you know, a very inexpensive garment that you got, let's say H&M, you bring it into your tailor and all of a sudden it looks stellar because they have fit it to your proportions. So make friends with your tailor. Just do it. It's there's no.
It's a funny thing though, you know, with women's fashion and that, because one of the curious things that happened in women's fashion, I think, is that, well, clothes that fit really well can often feel very grown up when you wear them. You know, they feel like you're wearing grown up clothes, which actually means you've bought something that might have some closet shelf life in your house. But it might, you know, the funny thing, you have to find a tailor. I'll give my, like, it's a bit of, like, I was going to say my Vogue advice, but it's actually tea advice now, which is that you have to find a tailor that understands how to make something perfect and then also how to tweak it so it's not perfect. Because when things aren't perfect, they're actually cooler for most women to wear. Like, if you don't want to quite look grown up, you want to have that moment where you're negotiating the dress and the dress is negotiating you. And often this is actually more the case in pants for women. You know how, like, perfect-fitting women's pants just make you look like you're wearing, like, mom pants or something? I don't know how else to describe it. Because what you really want is that look where, like, you were kind of tweaking a guy's pant and then you sort of fit it. Does that make any sense? And so you have to find a tailor who knows how to make it perfect and then make it slightly off. So you actually look better for having it. It's a strangest negotiation. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's always, there's always an aspect.
It's how you create the illusion. Yeah. How you create the illusion that your arm is thinner or your leg is this or that. And it's not necessarily giving you clothes that fit your body perfectly. It's giving you clothes that make your body look like the body that you wanted to have when you bought the thing.
But that was such a hard to do. That was a huge
killer
part in golden era Hollywood. That was a huge part of what the costume designers did back then. It was all about, you know, like Dietrich, who's known for her legs, had horrible breasts. So, you know, it was all about, her daughter
says
said that,
who?
Not me. you know, so it was all about masking certain flaws. And, you know, somebody had, you know, somebody's neck was too long, somebody's waist was too long. You know, it was all about cleverly masking those flaws, and they really did. And then, you know, I just was reading a new book, Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., this new book about the making of Breakfast at Tiffany's, and they were saying that the first person to change that was Audrey Hepburn in her Breakfast at Tiffany's attire, because they didn't care about masking her flaws at all. They just gave her this shift that showed off her extremely boyish, flawed body for that period of time, and that was that.
And that ruined it for all of us for the day.
I'm still stuck wearing her outfit.
I think it's come time on Jonathan's extremely wonderful Rolex, which he might not be getting back tonight.
Ruh-roh.
It's really nice. I think we're supposed to have questions now. And then I'm also should remind you that, again, Leslie will be signing the book after the question period. So there is a mic in the audience. Anyone has any questions? Please, questions.
Hi.
Hey,
everybody. Woo.
So thank you, everybody, for speaking. It's been kind of amazing. Jonathan. Hello.
Hi.
One thing that you were saying before is that it's great to make originality kind of you again and to make it better. What's the thing you're doing other than the equestrian horse thing that you think you're excited about that you're kind of recreating?
I make a squillion different things all the time, which is amazing and fun, and I'm so lucky. And I am excited about so many things I'm doing. I guess, to me, the most exciting thing is just the pots I make in the studio is always something that thrills me.
What about your books?
Oh, yeah, I have books coming out. Duh. I'm really excited about the new books that I've just written that are coming out in a month. Yes. Available on Amazon or jonathanadler.com.
I just want to preface this that I'm the one that always finds the hat at Leslie's dinner party.
It's true.
I just want to ask how you think something becomes a staple and not a period piece. Like, where as far as, I mean, I can kind of reference it in a film reference, where, like, something like Network becomes a classic, but whereas another film kind of becomes, I don't want to bash it, a film, but another film maybe that won the Academy Award, like Titanic, sort of just becomes of that moment and of that time, and you watch it now and you kind of laugh at it. You're like, how did I ever cry? How did I watch it 5 times in the theater? And I think the same goes with restaurants as well. When you look at Balthazar, and Balthazar was, you know, Madonna couldn't get a reservation, and a lot of restaurants at the time that were of that kind of stature are long since gone, but Balthazar has become this sort of classic New York entity, so.
I would say resonance. I mean, it just has to resonate with people in a certain way, and there's almost like an inexplicability to it. I mean, just look at the success, for instance, of something like, okay, perfect example. Okay, Social Network versus Wall Street 2. Everybody was, you know, setting up Wall Street 2 to be this big, you know, zeitgeisty thing, the collapse of the banks, this is our society again, but then everybody runs off and sees Social Network and everybody's like, this is us, and it ends up feeling like the graduate of our generation to many people. And so it's just, I guess maybe people have to, I don't know, see themselves in the product or relate to it or feel like it is showing an evolution reflects an evolution that they themselves experience. Or, I don't know, I mean, what do you think about that in terms of clothing?
Clothing, I mean,
what makes a clothing staple?
I think it has to be something you are not going to be tired of after two months, and you won't feel silly wearing it in 5 years. And you know, I think that's how, you know, that's how something is a classic or a new classic versus a trend.
I think it can be something that you wouldn't feel silly wearing in 5 years, or that you'd always feel silly wearing. I really do. I think it's like either the thing that you know you're silly when you wear it, you just have to wear it because it's like a marabou, I don't know, chubby, and you're always going to be a big bird in it, and that's why you. Or it has to be so basic and probably confirm a very youthful view of yourself, like a Levi's 501, where you were hot then, that you're fine. And you were hot in a really like underplayed, like it's like everyone who keeps talking about like APC jeans. I mean, you know what they're after. It's like that dark denim. I haven't done anything. I haven't creased. I don't have a whisker. I mean, that dark denim thing, and I'm really hot. You know, it has to be so elemental that, or I think it has to be totally over-the-top fanciful and like you knew you were silly. And I think probably the same is true for restaurants. It has to always be a kick to go there, or it has to almost from the start be like, we're beyond a kick. We're just a roast chicken, and we are a roast chicken. And I think McNally is very good at sort of understanding very quickly how to move from Madonna can't get a table to like, we have a roast chicken, and you know you're going to get it there, and it's just fine, right? It's like a really interesting trick. It's not having too clever a menu and not trying to be chic in a certain way and like wearing it very lightly, very quickly. You know, because places that try to stay too, in restaurants who try to stay too hot too long inevitably aren't hot. You know, it's like 150 Wooster Street and then it's gone. And most people in this room probably don't even remember 150 Wooster Street, but you really couldn't get in there like that. You know, remember?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah. I think that things you're talking about are things that are singular and where you can just sort of, like the urgency of the author of the experience, the movie, the restaurant, the whatever, is palpable. Those are the things that I think stick around forever. It's something where you can just tell whoever made it had to make it, and those things stay with you. It's emotional.
There are funny things, though. There are things that really resonate in sort of fashion style world, but maybe don't resonate for the rest of the public, and maybe aren't even that good, and maybe are even kind of laughable. Like, I mean, I felt the I Am Love, the Tilda Swinton's movie this year, right? That is a fashion movie, right? It's a blue shirt with an orange pant. You're like, I'm there. It's like, I'm there. I'm done. And it will always be a blue shirt with an orange pant. And it doesn't matter if the end's melodramatic. Does the sun have to die? No. Like, it doesn't matter because it's Tilda Swinton, and she wore those clothes, and it was a Raf Simon, and you're just there, right? And I kept thinking, it's the question of whether it's a good or bad movie, it'll always have that experience if you're that person who cares about aesthetics that much that you could even watch a kind of pastiche of Italian cinema of a certain time, right? It's like last year at Marion Budd, no reason for that movie to exist. But to fashion people, you know, it just exists and exists and exists. There's like a whole Chanel show based on it this for spring. And it's because it just is about the pure wonder of kind of things that make no sense except aesthetically to people who care. Am I making any sense?
Totally.
Yeah. So I know it doesn't have to be like the best movie of its time. It has to be a movie that, like, again, touches some weird part of you that just is pre-critical. It's just pre-critical. It's like what you would have thought you really had to be when you were 12. It's always that to me.
Yes, hi. I studied theology in college, and my Jesuit professor always said the tricky thing with nostalgia is you spend a lot of time focusing on how wonderful things were, and you forget how bad things were as well. And that's the tricky thing with nostalgia in this day. And Jason, you brought up the idea of shoulder pads. Shoulder pads had their place at their time, but in this time, they don't make sense. So I'm wondering, as you approach Jason and also Jonathan, consumer goods, goods that you sell in stores or in showrooms or what have you, how do you make sure that you are doing your due diligence so you're creating products that reference the past in a way that you think is salient in today's world, but at the same time not alienating consumers so you don't create something that has some fabulous element for 30 years ago, and yet a woman might say, yeah, but in 2010, this makes no sense for me and my body or in my home.
Well, I just think when I create something that has like some sort of historical reference, I always want to think about what makes sense for today's woman, my customer. And I think that's what, sometimes that's why I need to get out of the studio just to give myself a little reality check. And I think, you know, like the way that, for example, if I look at a, you know, fabulous 50s Charles James coat and I want to reference it, but, you know, how do I make it like a today's North Face coat and, you know, combine it with something that's so sporty and so now, yet has the beauty and the craftsmanship of that piece. And I think that's how I can reference something and still apply it to what makes sense for today.
I mean, I think the great thing about nostalgia is that, yeah, the eras one references might not have been so fab when they were happening. You know, there were a lot of fashion disasters and home disasters during those eras. But if you have time to look back, it's an amazing opportunity to distill and analyze and pick through what was fab and then redo it. It's like, it's kind of nice. It's a nice opportunity to sort of give props to the past and understand what was great.
It's like a rewind. You can, you know.
Okay, hi. I'd just like to say, first of all, that I am wearing shoulder pads.
Woo! Yes.
And I also just want to say thank you. This has been such a lovely evening. And I wanted to ask Leslie if you're doing any other events in New York around the book. And I mean, how do we get to have dinner with you?
We're doing an amazing event at Soho House on the 16th, and it's going to be called Forgotten Fashion. And actually, Professor Annie Frank of Parsons, who's here tonight with us, will be giving the most incredible presentation about America's once great, now forgotten, unjustly forgotten designers. And if anybody is interested in attending that, let me know afterwards. And we'll be doing a Forgotten Hollywood party at Soho House Los Angeles in January, and a bunch of signings and things like that. And dinners, I have to see how you look in a hat.
Hi. I think that there's a, again, thank you for a wonderful evening, but I think that there's one thing that pretty much most people are nostalgic about, even if they don't think they're nostalgic, and that's airlines and air travel. And I wanted to get from all of your perspective, you know, whether given, you know, geopolitics and economic realism and all sorts of other modern horrors, whether, you know, you could see on the aesthetics of the workers, the clothing, the interiors, like whether airline travel as it was, you know, is ever, whether it will ever be something that isn't sort of like going into a correctional institution ever again.
I'd like to see that.
Who travels the most?
Well, I don't travel a lot, but I'm opinionated. And I feel like traveling in today's economy cabins is like punishment from hell. And probably not. I mean, I feel like in a certain way, if an airline was smart and they really wanted to attract heaps of people, which they're having a hard time doing, they would create this wonderful experience again. Like, let's say we had a, you know, this beautifully, you ask Jason or Jonathan to design, you design the cabin and you design the uniforms, and it just becomes this incredible aesthetic experience, and you're showing, you know, old films. And I mean, I feel like Virgin Atlantic tried to do that a few years ago, and it was, you know, grand. Well, it was fresh, but then it became really old. But there, you know, there was a time when it was just really this lovely experience. I mean, unfortunately, you know, you could smoke in planes. I'm sure that was horrible. But there was one era when Dorothy Draper was designing, a very famous interior designer in American, designed a gilt airline cabin, and it was so modern and so incredible. And the buckles were gold gilt, and you know, it was just. This beautiful aesthetic experience, and I can't remember who designed the uniforms, but the stewardesses, they were called stewardesses then, were just pleasure to look at, and the food was divine, and like, who wouldn't want that again? And not even, you know, the business seats, first class seats are making an effort to create any kind of an aesthetic experience for anybody. They just seem intent on punishing us.
I mean, it's just so... Yeah, it's like a little bit of a punishment right now, but I mean, I feel like it's, I don't know if we'll ever go back to that. I mean, you know, it's right now, I feel like you're lucky to get a little water and...
a dry cracker.
And then the person doesn't snare at you.
But I think it's a two-way streak in a way, because, I mean, we demand different things from airlines now. People don't really want a meal on a plane because they're much fussier about what they eat, and they expect it won't be good, but even if it was good, they may not eat it because, I don't know, it has gluten in it or something. And then, you know, people really would like Wi-Fi to work on a plane. They don't really want the experience of watching someone else's movie. They just want to look at their emails. They're worried that they're not working. And, you know, people demand different things, and I think it's sort of a two-way streak. I think it used to be very exciting to fly places now, and now too many people fly too many places too much of the time. And so people view the airlines essentially as taxis that they've gotten into and gotten out of, and, you know, and they have to use a seatbelt, and that's annoying. And they don't sort of show up for it in the same way that they used to. I mean, maybe, you know, there's a lot. And sometimes, actually, if you're flying on, like, Emirates or something, and you're in, you know, you're flying through Dubai or something, you see a different class. You see people who are very dressed up to get on the plane. It's exciting for them. You know, if you see, I don't know, family, you know, wealthier Indian families going to Dubai to shop or something, you might see a different experience being enacted in different parts of the world on airlines, and therefore the experience for you might be actually better. But if, you know, if you're flying on Southwest because, you know, you're flying on Southwest or JetBlue, it's going to be what it is. And I don't know how that can be different, because it isn't just a matter of space. It isn't even just a matter if you fly like Open Skies or one of those things where you get more legroom or something. It isn't just a matter of space. It's a fundamentally... now uncomfortable experience. But I also know that for myself, when I fly, it's an uncomfortable experience because I somehow think I should be able to get from Paris to New York faster than I can. I mean, in some way, even though I never got to take the Concorde, and I would have never, no one would ever fly me on the Concorde, I somehow feel that we should all be able to fly on the Concorde now if we just be there. So I realize that's my own lack of appreciation of how genius it is that you can actually travel. You know, it's a certain jaded perspective. I think it's a bit of a two-way street in some ways.
I think it's possible to, I mean, in the Emirates, actually, I experienced it once, and I thought it was so fabulous. But then I thought, I think people would want to do it, but I think it would be so expensive that it wouldn't make sense. And then you think about, well, it's just for me to get from point A to point B.
But listen, if everybody, like, dressed the way Leslie dresses to go to the airport... I mean, the people who work at the airport would be a little more excited to work at the airport. The airport would be like a fun place to work. It would be like Balthazar back in the day, you know? And then the whole experience would be a different... I mean, if everyone was complicit in the same kind of set of gestures. And I think this book is so good at that, because it is sort of saying if people turn up with an idea of a kind of, you know, civility... it's going to be a more kind of pleasant, no matter what the external situation in the world is, good or bad, economic up or down, it's going to be a more generous and inviting place to be in this world. I think that's what's so, and it will be a world in which people drink and eat candy and do all sorts of things.
We can still drink, but then that's pretty much it.
There's a lot of drinking in here, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of drinking, a lot of candy in this book.
A lot of everything.
A lot of everything. A lot of lobsters popping out of pies. That's what you get if you meet with Leslie. That's your dinner. So are there any other questions? Or I think we're almost at the time where Leslie is now supposed to sign books.
Oh, can I say something before we sign and sign? One of the most flattering things that's ever happened to me is the rare books division of the library so lovingly curated a collection of artifacts in these two cases over here. Please look at them. It is just incredible. It's like certain things that were mentioned in the book. So like there's a first edition of Hemingway a first edition of Fitzgerald's Tender in the Night that's very saucily engraved to Lillian Gish and Hemingway and fountain pens and all these recipes. Like, it's amazing. Just look. Like some of the stuff that I wrote about, I met for the first time tonight in these cases, like the Yellow Book or books of Aubrey Beardsley, who's a very naughty Oscar Wildean illustrator. So my deepest gratitude for that. Thank you. And look.
Thank you for coming.